Not every day is a sunny day, and we're talking metaphorically now. Depression happens to millions of people around the country, and science continues to search for ways to address depression symptoms. A recent study combines a couple of approaches by focusing on something that turns into the acronym of MAP, Mental and Physical Training, MAP. In this case, the mental part was meditation, the physical part aerobic exercise. So what happened? The research is published in the journal Translational Psychiatry, and the principal author is Dr. Brandon Alderman, an assistant professor at Rutgers University in the Department of Exercise Science. Dr. Alderman, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeff.
There's some fascinating stuff in this article, specifically about neurons in a portion of the hippocampus. I mean, what do the neurons in the dentate gyrus do?
Well, it's actually debated in science what these newborn cells in the brain actually do. But since sort of the late 1990s, we knew that there are a number of behaviors that result in an increase in these new neurons in the hippocampus. And that's important because the hippocampus has long been known to play an important role in learning and memory.
And is it also part of depression, though, when that happens?
Well, we do know, we can't test this idea of neurogenesis or whether or not we have new neurons in the human brain as of yet. In animal models of depression, now these are actually quite difficult to perform and to know whether or not animals are actually experiencing what somebody who's suffering with depression might be dealing with. But we do know from animal models of depression that not only are there a smaller number of these new neurons that are produced, but in certain cases you can actually halt this neurogenic process altogether, suggesting that that if that's related to what some humans are experiencing, that you can, through depression or let's say through a traumatic experience, what might end up happening is that that would then be linked to some memory or learning problems that might even be exacerbated as one ages.
So is the general sense of what you're aiming for that if you can encourage neurogenesis in that portion of the brain, that perhaps depression might be less likely?
Yeah, Jeff, that's a really good question. And actually, I think a point that I should really try to drive home here. The fact that we can't assess this whole process of neurogenesis in the human brain means that we really have to use this evidence as inspiration for our MAP intervention, for our MAP training project. So even though I work with a behavioral neuroscientist who's been doing this work in neurogenesis for many years, Dr. Tracy Shores here at Rutgers, we got together and thought, well, you know, we are really on to something because she's been studying that. We can't really do it in the human brain. Exercise, we know, results in a robust increase in these new cells in the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus. Tracy's research has shown that if you engage in an effortful learning experience or effortful mental training that she has used with animals, that you can save or rescue some of these new cells. And so that whole idea from the basic neuroscience area was the inspiration behind combining exercise or physical training with some form of effortful mental training that we could have people engage in. And now that's debatable. What can you use for effortful mental training? And then we took this creative approach, and it has recency in science, and that is using a style of meditation called focused attention.
All right. I was going to ask you about the meditation part of things. So that's the M part of the MAP, the mental and physical training. And
that's right.
Why meditation rather than, I don't know, crossword puzzles or something else?
Yeah, that's actually a good question as well. We debated that. And arguably, I think for people in science, you know, a really good approach might be to see, you know, is there a style of cognitive training or attentional training that we could use in combination with exercise to really result in the most robust behavioral intervention for people who are suffering, like suffering from depression or another mental health disorder. We chose meditation for several different reasons. One, It's begun to really pick up steam in the Western world. So meditation has been used for thousands of years in the Eastern world. So there's more and more human neuroscientific literature demonstrating the benefits of various styles or traditions of meditation. And if you talk to people who've been meditating for much longer than I have, and you ask them about this idea of if it's effortful and if it's learning, the anecdotes or what you hear from them is that it's a lifelong process, and you never stop learning in meditation. And so it just seemed something that that actually really fit what we were doing when we were attempting to translate these research studies in animals to helping humans out.
And what we're talking about is mental and physical training, or by its acronym, MAP. Brandon Alderman is assistant professor at Rutgers University in the Department of Exercise Science. We're talking about MAP being used as a potential hedge against depression. Join us on The Exchange with questions or comments at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So in addition to having different kinds of mental training possible, and you went for the focused attention meditation, what kind of physical training?
Well, my lab in particular, we're very interested in all different types or modes of exercise and whether or not they result in similar benefits both to depression or cognitive function. So what are the cognitive and emotional enhancing properties of exercise? And do those differ? So if one was to do yoga versus going out and running, would they, especially chronically, so over a period of time, would there be differences between those? So are there unique benefits? We, in this study, we used aerobic exercise, and we chose aerobic exercise, I think primarily because the bulk of the research evidence, so a real large support from what we know now, is that you get more bang from your buck in terms of the brain-enhancing effects of exercise by engaging in aerobic exercise, by running. And I don't want to suggest that people shouldn't be engaging in other forms of exercise like resistance training. It's just that if you're going to do this in a study where it's novel and you're going to combine it with something like meditation, you really want to go for where you're really going to see the most effects.
All right, so we have aerobic exercise and focused attention meditation. How did you test things out and on whom?
So we were really interested in individuals who are suffering from depression, and there's an important aspect why, although I don't think that this intervention is just limited to people who have depression.
Okay.
Depression is characterized by a number of different symptoms, including cognitive complaints. So people who are dealing with depression often talk about they're having difficulty concentrating or difficulty with making decisions. And we and others had previously documented those cognitive deficits in depression. And along with those cognitive deficits, there's sort of a key aspect that might relate to why we would encourage people to combine or use both exercise and meditation. And that's an inability to inhibit or filter out negative, unwanted thoughts and or behaviors that accompany depression. And so rumination is a classic symptom of depression, and it's where people have, they struggle really trying to filter out the negative thought patterns that come up into consciousness. And so we've been studying this aspect of cognitive function using exercise, and it seems to make sense given what meditation is about, and that's the practice of training one's attention, that that combining meditation with aerobic exercise may, our initial hypothesis, our initial guess was that it would really have a strong effect on this aspect of depression, and that's those ruminative thought patterns.
To be really colloquial, is it really just needing to get out of your head, I guess we'd say?
It is. Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. And it's, are you able to let it go? Because all of us think about sort of negative things from time to time, but it's how long do you hold on to those negative thoughts?
Again, we're talking to Brandon Alderman at Rutgers University in the Department of Exercise Science about experiments with MAP training, mental and physical, to use as an approach to ward off depression. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Were any of the people in your study, the ones who were showing major depressive disorder, taking any medication for it?
They were, yeah. So we, part of the what we call our inclusion criteria when you design these studies is you have to think carefully about are some of these people going to be on some other form of either drug therapy, pharmacological therapy, or even cognitive behavioral therapy, and how do you deal with that? The way we approached this study is we included people into the study if they were on a stable antidepressant or if they were not currently on taking antidepressants. And then we looked after the fact as to whether or not that antidepressant use actually influenced the findings, and it didn't matter whether or not individuals were taking or not taking antidepressants. There was a similar cognitive and emotional improvement through MAP training.
So, but let me ask about the circumstances of either the mental or the physical training. I mean, obviously, that you showed them what to do. I mean, so how consistent were the circumstances of either the mental or the physical part for any of the people in the study?
I'm not sure if I get you in terms of how consistent, but let me tell you about the intervention itself.
Okay.
And also the adherence to the intervention. So we performed this intervention twice a week, and during those 2 days per week, we would have participants come in, and they would sit for a 30-minute session of meditation. And actually, we did 20 minutes of sitting-focused attention meditation where they focused on their breath. And following that, we had them do a slow walking meditation where the focus of attention moved to not only the breath but also the feeling of their foot, of their feet as they were walking in a slow circle around the room. Part of that was a transition so they could move from the meditation on into exercise. And then the exercise was a 30-minute bout of aerobic exercise on a treadmill or on a bike, on a stationary bicycle.
All right. That was what I was asking. It was whether it was supervised, and it was. It was there in front of the researchers the whole time. So it wasn't like they went off and meditated by themselves.
That's right. Yeah. So the meditation was very supervised. The exercise had a sort of a unique individual component to it, although we were certainly walking around giving as much motivation as possible.
Mm-hmm. So twice a week, and over what period of time?
So this happened over 8 weeks, and this I think was really part of the striking thing for me. When we performed the studies in my lab, one of the things that I always encourage my students to consider is, how do we disprove this? If you walk in and you think, hey, exercise is just great for everyone, I don't think it's a really great approach for science. We know that exercise is wonderful. We know it's a panacea. People don't take it on as a behavior, though, right? And so I always encourage my students to think about, how do you disprove the effects of some of these interventions? And when we walked into this MAP training intervention for depression, I have to say, I didn't think that across 8 weeks we were going to see such a robust effect. And I was surprised not only the dramatic reduction in symptoms of depression, it was roughly a 40% reduction in symptoms of depression among those who were clinically depressed at the outset, but the dose, so the amount of exercise that they were engaging in, is less than what is typically recommended for people to experience a reduction in depression. So if somebody came in and they had symptoms of depression and they said, can you tell me how much I should exercise? My recommendation would be more along the lines of 3 days per week at least for 45 minutes per session of aerobic exercise. And I would also encourage some resistance exercise as well. And by combining exercise with meditation, we were actually using a lower dose than what I and others would typically recommend.
So you write in the paper that it's generally accepted that either the mental or the physical part can reduce depressive symptoms. So why had nobody tried them together before?
You know, I think in science, one of the things that we've done is we often work in our own little labs and our own, they call them silos, and we often, you know, we're pursuing our own lines, like I could do that with exercise, and we often don't, I think, reach out as much as we should to say, oh, well, you know, you're working on this aspect and maybe in an attempt to enhance some aspect of human health. how can we join and see whether or not these types of things work in a synergistic way with one another. And I think that's kind of the unique aspect of the collaboration that we've developed here at Rutgers and our attempt to really not only understand how to reduce depression in these individuals, but also what are the mechanisms, what's going on here.
Were the results then with MAP beyond what had been shown in previous studies with just the mental or just the physical?
Yeah, that's right. So the magnitude of change in MAP training is larger than what is noted in the research literature, both for meditation alone or for exercise alone. Although I should say that's something that we're actually currently doing, is looking at how does the beneficial effect occur, and then what are the unique effects of exercise and meditation? So how do these things work uniquely, and then what's going on when you combine the two of them?
But finally, to just circle back to the beginning point of all this, given what we can and can't do in mapping the brain, do we have any way of knowing if neurogenesis is taking place because of this process?
Yeah, that leads to some areas of science that we're all here as well interested in. And remember, one of the ultimate goals and why we love the science that we're pursuing is that we're helping people. And so that's a really important aspect. But we're also scientists, and we're really interested in that. So an important part of this study that was recently published is that we were recording EEG, brain activity from electroencephalography from mm-hmm. these individuals. And so we were looking at aspects of cognitive function that I was referring to earlier, and that's these aspects of cognitive function that are involved in decision-making or cognitive flexibility, or importantly, that ability to inhibit or filter out the ruminative thought patterns. And so what we found with this brain electrical activity is that from before to after MAP training, there was actually an improvement in these neurophysiological signals, suggesting that ability to inhibit or filter out the ruminative thoughts was correlated with this improvement in brain function. So although we weren't focused on the hippocampus per se, we were still demonstrating at a neural level that these improvements were they're demonstrated both at a behavioral level and at a neural level.
Let's take a call. We have Sandy in Mount Shasta on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Brandon Alderman from Rutgers University.
Yeah, hi, Jeffrey, and hi, Brandon. Great show, great topic. I'm someone who has attempted to establish a consistent medication practice for decades and have had great difficulty maintaining it. I'll resolve to do it, and then something will distract me, and I'll completely forget about it. And I think I've discovered that there are certain, and I've talked to other people who have the same problem, and I want to ask you a question after I say this. I think I've discovered that some people find sitting quietly actually, I don't know, maybe activates the amygdala or something, but it feels like almost dangerous to some part. And I'm wondering if any aspect of your work has dealt with this kind of a phenomenon. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Andy. Appreciate that.
So Andy brings up a really important point that I should get across. Now, I am not an expert in this area, so I'm going to tread really carefully here.
Okay.
But I'll tell you what I've learned, that when you engage in a focused style of meditation, if you're going to attempt to do this on your own, an important thing to really be careful, this doesn't happen in many cases, but it does happen in some, that people with a history, let's say a traumatic life history or some traumatic event in their life, when they sit and they're engaging in focused meditation, so when they are, you know, training the attentional system, when they're focusing attention on a chosen object, in our case, we use the breath, often what can happen is thoughts arise unconsciously. So your attention moves off of the breath, and you'll have some thought that just comes up in your mind. And often these can be these experiences, these traumatic experiences from the past. So it's really important for people who are depressed or have some history, you know, let's say it's post-traumatic stress disorder, that you're talking with your primary health care provider about your use of meditation, and you're working with people who have done this for a long time.
So the essential, ask your doctor before doing this, which, with either the physical or the mental part, it sounds like.
Yeah, and, you know, I really like that point, and I'm going to try to drive this home because, you know, if people are taking antidepressants or if people are using cognitive behavioral therapy, I think it's really important that you bring the primary health care providers in on this conversation and talk to them and say, hey, I really am interested in incorporating more exercise and maybe exercise and meditation into my life. And so how can I do this? And how can I do it in concert with these other treatments that I'm currently taking?
I don't know, Dr. Alderman, if I asked or you said how many people were involved in the research with the MAP training.
Yeah, so the number, we ended up having 52 participants completed the intervention. You know, you do have a slight drop off in any sort of clinical trial. I think if this was a longer clinical trial, we might have an even greater drop off in some of our participants. But the adherence was actually quite high relative to other exercise studies. I'm not sure about meditation studies, but relative to other large clinical trials with exercise, we had a really high adherence rate, and so it makes you wonder why. It could be perhaps that we were only doing it twice a week. We were also very flexible with the times that would work in people's schedules.
I mean, certainly,
but lastly, there just might have been something rewarding about combining meditation with aerobic exercise.
Okay, mental and physical training, as it's come to be known, MAP, M-A-P. Dr. Brandon Alderman is an assistant professor at the Rutgers University Department of Exercise Science. The research is published in Translational Psychiatry. And thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange, Dr. Alderman.
Thank you, Jeff, for having me. I really enjoyed it.
All right, take care.